And so at any rate, I'd totally forgotten that I was speaking today, and so I don't have something prepared for Father's Day. So I apologize for that. But we're going to talk about Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. So if you'll open your Bibles to Nebuchadnezzar, or rather Daniel 4. Could be Nebuchadnezzar, you know. He's Oh boy, I can tell this is going to start off great here. You know, I was going to talk about pride for today, and I think my pride was just brought down a few notches there. But at any rate, what I'm going to talk about today certainly applies to fathers. And the one thing that I have learned as I've been a father is that it's the hardest job you will ever do. And so for everyone in here who's a father, I think you'll find that to be the case. It's the hardest thing that you will ever do in life to be a dad, because it requires something from us. I was reading in a book this week about pain, and the author in the book made a profound comment, and I looked at it and I thought, I don't quite get this, and so I thought about it for a little while. And when I shared it later on with some ladies in the office at school, they didn't get it either. So I felt like I was in good company. But basically, the comments were this, and that is that people suffer because other people don't suffer enough. And I thought about that, and I thought, what in the world does he mean by that? People suffer because other people don't suffer enough. And as I began to look at that, he went on to explain that the reason that some people suffer is because other people are not willing to suffer denying themselves. And so as they refuse to deny themselves, they cause other people to suffer because they cause people to do things or suffer in ways because they want what they want. They're not willing to take a back seat to anyone. They're not willing to say no to themselves and suffer. And it's really a definition of what it is to be a father, isn't it? What you're really saying when you take that child in your arms for the first time and you're holding them and you're giving them the bath is what you're saying to that child is, I am going to suffer for you. And oftentimes we need to be reminded of that, don't we? That it's a suffer. It's a time of us denying ourselves. And if you're not willing to do that as a father and as a husband, you ought not to begin the process. And so encouragement in that, and also warning that if you want to be a father, you're planning to be a father, or you are a father or a grandfather, remember that you were called into this thing of being a father for the purpose of suffering. All right, is that an encouragement to you? All right. And our wives will often remind us of that. Kathy has to remind me of that quite often. I'll not share with you the things that she tells me, but she oftentimes has to remind me of that. That being a father means that you're going to suffer, and it's only for a short period of time, and unfortunately it's very short, that we get to experience this and we get to enjoy this. A few days ago, the world's greatest boxer, in many people's opinion, was laid to rest, and we all know who that was whom. It's Muhammad Ali. All right. Cassius Clay was, yeah. So in his heyday, when he was a heavyweight champion, he was taking a trip on a 747, and as they started down the highway for takeoff, the flight attendant came by, and she looked out at him. She noticed he didn't have his seatbelt on, and she said to him, she said, please fasten your seatbelt, sir. And he looked at her, and he very proudly snapped, and he said, Superman don't need no seatbelt. And she looked at him, and she said without hesitation, she said, Superman don't need no plane either. So his pride was brought down just a little bit there. But oftentimes in our arrogance, we think that, don't we? We think we don't need a seatbelt. We don't need these little things that help us in our life. And today we're going to learn about the Superman of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, and how he learns that he needs a seatbelt, and what it means to be under God's control. So if you look with me there in Daniel 4, we're going to read 1 through 18. We're not going to finish a chapter because it's way too long to try to get through. As a matter of fact, we'll probably run over today. So if you plan to leave at 12, forget that. We're gonna run over a little bit. So he starts off, and this is a letter that he's written. He's written this letter to the peoples of the world. And he starts off and he says, King Nebuchadnezzar. So back in those days, when they would begin a letter, they would put their name at the beginning rather than waiting and putting their name at the end. They would just simply say, George or Sam or whoever, my letter to you. And so he starts it off and he says, King Nebuchadnezzar, to those of every people, nation, and language who live in all the earth, may your prosperity increase. I am pleased to tell you about the miracles and wonders the Most High God has done for me. How great are his miracles and how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an eternal kingdom and his dominion is from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and flourishing in my palace, and I had a dream and it frightened me. You kind of get the impression that this guy dreams a lot, don't you? It seems like every chapter we're into a dream here with him. And he gets frightened here oftentimes with these dreams because God takes him by the hand. Now listen to this for just a moment. God will take you by the hand and he's going to shake you in life. And oftentimes it's not an enjoyable thing to be shaken. But God always does what he does with us, and he always shakes us when he does because he loves us. Just as we, when we look at our children as fathers and we say, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. We do it for a purpose. And when he shakes us, so when he comes upon us and he makes us tremble in front of him, he's doing it because he loves us, because he knows what's best for us. So Nebuchadnezzar here is frightened in his dream, and he has these visions, and they alarm him. And so he issues a decree to bring all the wise men of Babylon to him in order that they might make the dream's interpretation known to me. So when the diviner priests and mediums and Chaldeans and astrologers come to him, he looks at them and he says, I told them the dream, but they could not make its interpretation known to me. Finally, Daniel, named Belteshazzar after the name of my God and the spirit of the holy gods is in him, came before me. And I told him the dream. Belteshazzar, head of the diviners, because I know that you have a spirit of the holy gods and that no mystery puzzles you, explain to me the visions of my dream that I saw and its interpretation. In the visions of my mind, as I was lying in bed, I saw this. There was a tree in the middle of the earth, and its height was great, and the tree grew large and strong. Its top reached to the sky, and it was visible to the ends of the earth. Its leaves were beautiful, its fruit was abundant, and on it was food for all. Wild animals found shelter under it. The birds of the air lived in its branches, and every creature was fed from it. And as I was lying in my bed, I also saw in the visions of my mind an observer, a holy one, coming down from heaven, and he called out loudly, cut down the tree and chop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But leave the stump with its roots in the ground and with a band of iron and bronze around it. In the tender grass of the field, let him be drenched with dew from the sky and share the plants of the earth with the animals. Let his mind be changed from that of a man and let him be given the mind of an animal for 7 periods of time. Those 7 periods of time, by the way, are 7 years. This word is by decree of the observers. The matter is a command from the holy ones. This is so the living will know that the Most High is ruler over the kingdoms of men. He gives it to anyone he wants and sets over it the lowliest of men. This is a dream that I, King Nebuchadnezzar, had. Now, Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because none of the wise men of my kingdom can make its interpretation known to me, but you can, because you have the spirit of the holy gods. All right, so the first thing I want us to take a look at as we look at this is that Nebuchadnezzar comes to grip with who he is as a man, and he comes to grip with who he is in God's eyes. And you see, some people will spend a whole lifetime trying to find themselves. You often hear people saying, I'm trying to find out who I am. And as men, we oftentimes fall into that temptation because about the time we reach the mid-40s, the early 50s, which we try to find out who we are because we realize something's going on with us, and that is we're getting older. And so Nebuchadnezzar is in that belt of time. He's in that middle age period where he's trying to find out, who am I? What's my purpose? I've spent my whole life enjoying myself, doing what I want to do, but it's not fulfilling me. Who am I and what am I going to become? And so as he does that, he's trying to find direction because he's trying to avoid something, and that's the sand of time. And he's realizing that the sand of time is beginning to run out of his glass. And it won't be long until he'll be on the sands that never run out, on the bank of that river where we have to make a decision, where we've already made a decision and we'll receive the reward of our decision, where we're going to spend eternity. You know, a few weeks ago, a little over a month ago, I sat by the bed of my father as he was dying. And I had that opportunity to sit there with him and read scripture to him and just talk with him. And then to see him the next morning lying on that same bed where he had passed away and looking at him lying there, it reminded me of the frailty of life. And just yesterday I was driving in my car and I was thinking about him and I thought, I wish that I could have just one more moment with him. And then I could just hold his hand, and I just thought to myself, I wish I had stayed the night and spent a little more time just talking with him. And it was a precious thing just to have that. But he's realizing here that the sands of time are beginning to run out on him. And as time begins to run out, he loses everything he's worked for. He's realizing that something's happening here, and he's on the verge of losing it all because he's worked his whole life to have this kingdom. He's poured himself into it. He's sacrificed people for the purpose of his kingdom. He's poured himself into it. And yet he's finding that it's really not satisfying because his spiritual journey that began in chapter 2 is now beginning to turn into a life-changing encounter with the living God. Look at verses 1 through 3 and look at how the stage is set for what we're going to learn. If we examine Nebuchadnezzar's proclamation in chapter 3, we notice that it's all about him. If you look back at that, you'll notice it's replete with command. You will do this, or else I will tear you limb for limb. You will speak kindly of this God, or else I'll turn your house into a dunghill. But notice in verse 1 through 3 in chapter 4, he writes his proclamation to the known world, and his message is totally different. And the first thing that he does is he comes up with two main points in this message, and that is, first of all, there's a God in heaven who rules in the affairs of men. There is a God in heaven who knows your life intimately. And no matter who you are or what you do, God knows who you are, and he has his hand on your life. And it's up to you to make the decision to either respond positively to that and allow him to take your life and allow him to make something out of your life, or to refuse that, and he will never force you to follow him. And that is your decision. So if you take a look at those verses again, I want you to understand something, and that is there's a direct link between what's going on in his life and the country that we live in today. As a matter of fact, when this country first began in 1787, as the delegates were creating our constitution, they were at a gridlock, and it was threatening to stop everything. As a matter of fact, some of the delegates were ready to pull out and go back to England because the country was on the verge of falling apart. And if that had happened, there most likely would not be a United States today. We very well may still be under English law and English rule, or we may be under the tyranny of some other country. But because these men began to work together and realize that it's not as important to have my way, but to work together, they began to compromise. And all of that began with a simple statement by one man, and that man's name was Ben Franklin. And as he sat there and he listened to these different factions bickering about who was going to be the strongest and who was going to be in control, he realized that something was missing. And so he rose up and he addressed the delegates and he said this. He looked at the one who was in charge. He said, "Mr. President, the small progress that we have made after 4 or 5 weeks, methinks a melancholy proof of the imperfection of human understanding. We indeed seem to feel our want of political wisdom since we've been running about in search of it. We've gone back to ancient history for models of government. We've viewed modern states all around Europe, but none of their constitutions suitable to our circumstances. In this groping, as it were, in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding? Let me ask you a question. When you go to make a decision about your career, when you go to make a decision about the things you do, do you come to God and do you talk with Him first? You know, I think that's one of the things that we lack, don't we? I do. Oftentimes I'll make decisions, I'll think of things, and I'll decide on a path, and I'll not even bother at all to go to the Author of Lights, the Father of Lights, and look at Him and say, would you please give me some illumination here? Would you give me some wisdom so that I can make a good decision? And oftentimes we go off and we just do our thing, and then we come to Him as the results begin to crumble because we realize we made a poor choice. We come running to Him and say, will you please get me out of the mess I just created for myself? So we go walking down through the field of time, and we step in the little cow patties that are scattered all over the place. Get your mind on that. Put your mind there for just a minute. Think about it. Think about what we do. We go walking through the little field, and we stick our little feet in our cow patties that we've created, and then we go running to Him and say, will you please wash my feet for me? Think about it for just a minute. That's about what it's like, isn't it? That's what we do. And then He goes on, and He says this. To that kind providence we owe this happy opportunity of consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future national felicity. And we now have forgotten, or have we now forgotten that powerful friend, or do we imagine that we no longer need His assistance? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men, and if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without His notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without His aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without His concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided in a little partial local interest. Our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven, its blessings on our deliberations, be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business. I want you to think about that. We can rest on that. You see, God has a keen interest in continuing the actions of our present government. So easy during this political time. I've never seen such a political time as we're in today. But it would be easy to lose hope and begin to think it's all just a mess. It's all just going to fall apart. But God has a keen interest in our country. And He has established this country for one purpose. And that, again, as I've told you before, is to spread the gospel throughout the world. To be an example of what it's like to be a Christian nation, no matter what our president or any other people say. The second message I want you to look at here in these verses 1 through 3, and that is He's conveying to His readers a desire to tell them how God of the Jews, the God of the Jews, has affected His outlook on life. So that's the second point He's making here, and He's making clear that human kingdoms are subject to change. Look at verse 3, that God's kingdom is eternal, but people change and kingdoms change. And I want you to think about this for just a moment. This was a dramatic change from the king who just a very few years before was ready to burn anyone to a crisp, who refused to bow to an image of himself. And I want you to take a look at verse 4 and notice the difference a few years begins to make in his life. Look at what happens to him in verse 4. First, he was content. Look at it there. He's content. He's living in an environment where everything is going his way. He's prosperous. He's at ease with his situation in life. History records that after finishing his wars in Syria and Egypt, he actually went on a building program throughout Babylon, and it enjoyed uninterrupted peace and prosperity in his palace. All over the kingdom, he began to build these huge ziggurats going up to the heavens, just like the Tower of Babel. You remember the Tower of Babel was established there in Babylon. That's where it occurred. So all of these ziggurats are going up everywhere, all of these temples to all these different gods, and he's living in style. He builds the hanging gardens for his wife. The most one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. All of these different terraces, all of the water brought up to it with different types of machinery that you couldn't even see. They were all hidden so that she could enjoy what it was like to live in a mountain kingdom. It reminded her of where she came from. So he's a prosperous man. He has this building program. And as we look at this passage, it'd be easy to assume that God looks disapprovingly on people who are successful. You know, sometimes as Christians, we begin to think that if you're successful, that somehow that means that you're out of tune with God. You ever notice that? You ever notice how Christians kind of glory in looking like they are frumpy? You ever seen that? You know what I mean? You ever go to some Christian circles where the people will dress very, very plain, and they have a sour look on their face because they don't want to look like they're enjoying life? Their faces make a good sign for a vinegar factory. You ever seen that? And God does not disapprove of wealth. God does not disapprove of people looking like they have wealth. And the Bible's teaching us here that there's something that comes into a man's mind when he has this wealth that's the problem. Listen to this verse in Ecclesiastes 11:9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. In other words, be happy in what you're doing. If God has gifted you to be a builder, then build with gusto. If he's gifted you to build, to be a musician, sing songs with gusto. If he's gifted you to be an athlete with gusto. There's nothing wrong with being a person of success and of wealth. But Solomon finishes this verse with a warning, and that's the warning he's giving to Nebuchadnezzar here in this passage. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Now, what does that mean, God's going to bring us into judgment for what we've done? He's not going to judge us because we have made money. He's not going to judge us because we've been successful in life. But what he's going to judge us on is how we've handled that. He's weighing our motives and our actions. What do we do with what God has given us? If we have talents, how do we handle those talents? If we have gifts, how do we handle that? If we have money, how do we handle our money? Is it all about us? Do we use our money simply to enjoy life for us? Or do we take our money and we look at it and we say, God, this is your money. I'm going to enjoy life. I'm going to drive a nice car. I'm going to have a boat. I'm going to have a plane. But God, this is your money. How can I use it for you? How can I do what I do for you? If I'm an athlete, how am I going to honor you as an athlete? And you see, some people get really hung up on this, and they think that if they have money or nice things, they're just not spiritual. Kathy and I got into this, or at least I did years ago. We bought a new living room suit, and I like leather. And leather's expensive. And so when we bought our couch, and we bought our chair, and we bought our love seat, I bought leather. And I felt guilty because I bought leather, because I probably spent $2,000 or $3,000 more on buying leather than if I had bought cloth. But I don't like cloth. I like leather. And I wanted it. And so I bought it. And the interesting thing about that was every time Christians would come over, I would apologize for my leather. Our pastor came over and he sat down on the couch. And he said, oh, I see you got new furniture. And immediately I felt guilty. And I said, well, we got it on sale. Isn't that interesting how Christians are embarrassed if they have something nice? Isn't that a shame that we would feel that way? You see, God doesn't look down on us if we have nice furniture, if we have a nice car. You know, sometimes I think Christians feel like if they get a brand new car, they need to go out and kick the door in and put a dent in it just to make it look like, you know, acceptable. You see, our Nebuchadnezzar was not brought into judgment because he had things, but because he had made them his God. And you see, what God wants us to do is he wants us to examine. He wants us to look at ourselves so that he doesn't have to do it for us. You see, every day God looks at us and he examines us and he reminds us through his word, examine yourselves, see if you're in the faith. Take a look at what you're doing. Look at your motives. And he does that specifically so that he doesn't have to do it. And I want you to think about something. It's when you look at your life as you're sitting there today and God is working in your heart and he's talking to you right now, think about it for just a minute. Are your ways glorifying to him? Are the things you're seeking, is it building others up? Is the way you're living as a father, is that building up your children? Is it building up your wife, or are you constantly pulling them down? Someone once said that it takes five positives to overcome one negative. Five positives to overcome one negative. So if you say one negative thing to your children, or say one negative thing to your spouse, or say one negative thing to a coworker, you need five things positive to say just to overcome that one thing. Amazing when you think about it. So the second thing that he learns here in verses 6 through 7 is that the priests and the magicians could not interpret his dream. But notice how he reacts. He doesn't go in a tirade this time. He doesn't threaten that he's going to put anyone to death. And God has begun to do a thing in his life and has begun to bring a measure of control to his countenance so that when he suffers these injustices to his psyche, he doesn't look at people and say, well, I'll just tear you limb from limb and burn you in a furnace because you didn't do what I want you to do. God's working in his heart. It's an amazing thing to watch God begin to work in people's hearts. Have you ever noticed that? Have you ever noticed someone when they become a Christian, God begins to work in their heart? He doesn't necessarily work on whose timetable? Ours. But he begins to work in them. He begins to knead them like a lump of dough. And he begins to change who they are inside. And that's what he's doing here with Nebuchadnezzar. Look again at verses 8 through 18. And we're going to talk here about the dream. And I want you to notice again that despite numerous lessons to the contrary, he continues to make the same mistake. He continues to call in the same group of people. And we've all heard the comment made, attributed to Albert Einstein, that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. So every time he has one of these dreams, every time he has one of these crises, the first thing he does is he goes to the magicians and wise men, and they've never been able to do it for him. Never once has it been recorded that they actually came to him and told him his dream and explained the meaning of them. And yet he goes to them first every time. But then look at verse 8 and look what happens here. Finally, he calls in his old friend Daniel. And look at his confession as he looks at him. Look what it says there. The first thing he says to him is, no mystery puzzles you. All things are an open book to you. Well, now you would have thought that since he knows this, that he would have gone to Daniel first. Why waste your time? And I want you to think about that for just a moment. How many times do we do that? As soon as a crisis begins to erupt in our marriage or crisis begins to erupt in our life, who do we go to? We go to Facebook, right? Or we begin to text people. And we begin to put all of our dirty laundry out there for all the world to read, but we refuse to go to the one who already read it. And it's a lesson for all of us to know that if we've got an issue, if we've got a problem, get down on your bony knees and go to the one who can actually solve the problem. Because the people beside you can't solve it. They've got the same problem. And they can't do anything about it. But if you go to the one who can actually solve the problem, as he now goes to Daniel, you'll find that you'll get the answer you're looking for. Or at least the answer God wants you to have. So look what happens here. He goes to him and he says, first, no mystery puzzles you. And the second thing, the spirit of the holy gods is in you and you speak with power because that power lives in you. And look what he says to him. He starts to share the dream in verse 10 through 12. And he shares by describing, first of all, what he saw. And the first thing that he saw here was he saw a tree, and this tree is in the center of the earth. It's in the middle of the earth, and all power and all attention is focused on this tree. It's a mighty tree. And notice also that the tree started as nothing. It actually grew and flourished. Scholars tell us that Babylon began as a very minor power. As a matter of fact, about 100 years before this, it was almost nothing. Babylon was a defeated power at that time, overrun by the city of Nineveh and the Syrians, a total nothing. And then two or three kings before Nebuchadnezzar, one of them being his father, began to build it into a powerful kingdom. And then Nebuchadnezzar came on the scene and did the same. But this power and this greatness actually began during the time of Daniel. And Daniel watched all of this happen. He watched all of these building projects. As a matter of fact, he was part of the process as an advisor to the king. And the second thing that he says here as he's describing this dream is a tree grows large and strong and its top reaches to the sky and it was visible to the ends of the earth. The tree was very, very large, verse 11. As a matter of fact, Babylon's empire was so large it covered all of what is known as the Middle East today down into Egypt, one of the largest empires that has ever been on the scene. But not only was the tree large, but it was visible to the ends of the earth. And I want you to think about this for just a moment, the power of Babylon to influence the lives and the workings of all of the other empires of the world continues to this day. As a matter of fact, every Easter we celebrate something called Easter. It comes from the Babylonian god Ashtar. And the little Easter eggs people give are Ashtar eggs from the fertility goddess Ashtar. Also, the writing of the Jews, if you look at the Hebrew script that they use, it comes to us from Babylon. That's the Babylonian script, a total different form of script. So they continue even today to be visible. This tree is still visible in our lives today, every year. But if you look in verse 12, you'll notice that something happens also here, and that its leaves are beautiful and its fruit is abundant. In other words, just as a tree is growing with plenty of water and a fertile soil is lush, his kingdom is filled with plenty of resources to draw from, a land that's flowing with milk and honey, plenty of money, plenty of everything. And at a time in the world where people lived on the verge of starvation every year, this kingdom was a continual flourishing kingdom, a kingdom that was prosperous. But notice in verse 13 and 17 what happens here. Because God is watching. You remember the song from a few years ago, God is watching us from a distance? You see, God's not watching us from a distance. God's watching us very intimately. As a matter of fact, he's watching your thoughts right now. He knows what you're thinking. He knows what you're doing. He knows what you'll be thinking later on today. He knows the purpose of your life. And look at what happens here in Job 34:21. The Bible tells us, for his eyes are upon the ways of men, and he sees all his steps. And notice in verse 14, the extent of the judgment to which these watchers are going to subject Nebuchadnezzar, these angels from heaven, these ones that God has assigned to do this. First of all, the tree is going to be cut down. So everything is going to be removed. Everything is going to be destroyed. And the second thing is the tree's power, its branches would be stripped from it. But notice also it's not enough for God to simply break the branches off, to cut the branches off, but he also strips them of their leaves. Think about it for just a minute. When you go out and you cut down a tree, do you take those limbs and grab the limbs and strip all the leaves off? No. You just simply cut them off, you pile them up and get them ready to burn. But God says, I'm going to do this entirely. I'm going to destroy him completely. I'm not just going to cut you down, but I'm going to destroy you. And it's an amazing thing when we get in that crucible of God's judgment. And I want you to think about this for just a moment. All of us live lives in which God is working in us. And he's talking to us and he's moving in us and he's trying to do things through us. But there's a warning with that. And that is God is weighing us. He's looking at us. And he's trying to get us to turn to him. But if we look at him with stubborn necks the way Nebuchadnezzar did, he will destroy us, he will cut us down, and he will strip our leaves from us. And I want you to think about something else here. The other thing he takes from him is the fruit or his possessions. All of these things will be scattered. In other words, nothing that he has will be his. In an echo of this prophecy, John the Baptist warned the Jews in Matthew 3:10, and this is what he said to them. He said, even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Therefore, every tree which does not bear good fruit is cut down and is thrown into the fire. And so this tree would be completely destroyed. But notice in verse 15, God's mercy, the stump would remain. And I want you to think about that for just a moment. When you get in that crucible where God's dealing with you and he's working you, he will always leave a stump. He will always look at you and he say, I will not destroy you completely. I will bring you back. Turn to me. Come to me. And look what happens here as he leaves a stump. The first thing that he does is he puts something around the stump. If you've ever cut a stump down or a tree down, you'll notice that pretty soon that stump will begin to split. And so what God is doing here to keep the kingdom from splitting is he's putting two bands around the stump. And the first one I want you to see there is he places an iron band around it. And this symbolizes Christ's rule with a rod of iron. This symbolizes God's power, his unending power and his total power over this kingdom, this band of iron. And the second band he puts around the stump symbolizes the concept of Christ's appearance in Revelation 1:15, and that's the purity of Christ. Listen to the verse. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace. So there's a twofold power that Christ has here that he's placing over this kingdom, and that is absolute rule, and the second one is his absolute purity, the purity of his intentions. And I want you to think about that for just a moment. When God's working with you, when he's working in your life, it's the purity of his intentions. He never does it to harm. The old hymn goes like this, never to harm. The words just escape me. I only design thy dross to consume, thy gold to refine. God always works in us in two ways, absolute control, and the second one is an attitude of purity. Now, I want you to take a notice that something else is going to happen to him. Not only is his kingdom going to be removed from him, not only is it going to be protected, but he's going to be turned into something, and that is an animal man. Look at verse 16. He'll be stripped of his insanity. He's going to be driven from mankind, and he's going to live like an animal for 7 years. This condition is something called lycanthropy, which means wolf man. And studies conducted in modern times suggest that this condition occurs occasionally with persons imagining themselves to be various types of animals. In 1946, a man in a mental hospital imagined himself to be a cow, and he actually would go around and eat grass just like a cow. There have been people recorded even today who think that they're cats, and they'll go around trying to use a litter box like a cat. So that this condition is a mental condition, but God brings it upon him because most of these mental conditions only last for a short period of time. But in this condition, God places it upon him for 7 years. Can you imagine what that was like? 7 years of where he's being judged, 7 years where he's living like an animal. And notice again in verse 17, the reason for this judgment. There's a reason here, and this is so the living will know that the Most High is ruler over the kingdom of men. You see, the problem that Nebuchadnezzar struggled with is a problem that we all struggle with, and that's the issue of pride. You see, each of us has this problem. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said it this way. He said, pride grows in the human heart like lard on a pig. Think about that for just a moment. Pride, this evil of pride in our hearts. Dennis Rainey once wrote this. He said, pride is one of the few things that can grow in the human heart without any sustenance. And although it seems to flourish more visibly in some people, all the human race suffers under its malignant grip. The evangelist D.L. Moody once said this. He said, God sends no one away empty except those who are full of themselves. I want you to think about this for just a moment as we are closing, as we're wrapping this up. The length that God had to go to in order to teach this lesson to Nebuchadnezzar was important and enormous. And I want you to think about it. As we're thinking about this, let's close our eyes and let's reflect for just a moment on our own lives. I want you to think about what length does he have to go with you? What length does he have to go with us to teach us the same thing? That pride is an abomination to him. That our arrogance is an abomination. That any focus other than focus on him is an abomination to him and is sin in our own lives. Think about it. Let's all stand. Our Father, we look to you. We ask you to look at us, look at our hearts. This is a special, special passage in your word in which you take a man and you break him. Father, break each of us. Help us as we consider ourselves as fathers today to be broken before you and consider what it's like to humble ourselves and be servants of our families. Help us as men and women to consider where we are in relation to you and what we're doing as we walk with you. Help us to walk in humility and brokenness before you. Cleanse our hearts of sin, of inner sin. Transform us as we look to you, as we come to you. In the beautiful name of Jesus Christ, amen.